This is the People's Game for June 22nd, the 12th day of the 2010 World Cup Soccer Tournament in South Africa. We'll be talking with co-host Jennifer Doyle about what it means for Southern California to have both Mexico and South Korea advance to the second round. Then we're joined by Lazar Trashan, who's on cloud nine in La Celeste like all of his native Uruguay. Fernando Romero reflects on a less impressive Mexico that now must prepare for Argentina, who put in a flawless performance to eliminate Greece. Then we check in with Hamoud Salih, who tells of the fervor gripping Algeria before their showdown with the USA. And then Kevin, a German partisan in Los Angeles, tells us why he remains confident that his side will take Ghana tomorrow. And lastly, Ian Masters, whose great-uncle was the captain of the Australian national side in the 1920s, expresses his nation's frustration with the refereeing while remaining hopeful that the Socceroos can pull a miracle against Serbia tomorrow. All that and more on The People's Game. This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined by my co-host on The People's Game, Jennifer Doyle of the great blog From a Left Wing. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Alan. I am recovering after a very intense morning. It was my first time ever watching two games at once, and basically for me it was a triangulated story in which France and Mexico were really playing each other. Because, of course, when France gave up two goals pretty quickly to South Africa, that opened up the possibility that South Africa could score four and then thereby knock Mexico out of the tournament. And as much as I wanted to root for the host country, I obviously can't. I mean, I have to root for Mexico. So I was, you know, biting my nails. I was terrified on the edge of my seat, which was my living room, and very, very much relieved by the result. And, of course, I was also, because of this long-standing interest in the French side, I've been completely riveted to by all of the drama. And so I was really intrigued to see just what kind of a game they would play with this incredibly, this emotionally saturated story going on behind the scenes of this total implosion of the, not just the team, but it actually seems like the actual infrastructure of the L'Équipe de France, which is often invoked in French press as sort of the term which describes more than just the players, but the coach and the training staff and the National Football Federation. It all seems to be coming apart, and there's a much, much bigger story there than Anelka losing his temper and swearing at his coach. And this is obviously, you know, a whole organization coming down on itself, and the players, I think, are just the most visible, are the most visible faces, right, of a larger problem. So, after all of that, I couldn't even really bear to watch any more football. I was completely drained by the drama of just that 90 minutes, but 90 minutes of two games all at once. So that was basically my morning. Was just riding the waves of, is Mexico going to qualify or be kicked out by a miraculous South African performance against the most dispirited team ever? And then meditating on the French problem and the French question and what's going on. I don't think we'll know for weeks. I think it's going to take a while. And I think what we'll find is a story about the generation gap between the people who run European football and the people who play the game. And this kind of emerging, I think, institutional problem insofar as there's a real meaningful difference between the people who we're watching on television and then the people who are speaking as officials of the sport. So it's been said that one of the people associated with the French Football Federation called Anelka a thug. If I understand right, the word was not thug but voyou, which is, I mean, of course, you know, in French it's a word that you use to describe someone that you can't leave your purse near. I mean, it's worse than the term thug because it's not just a posture. It suggests that a person of criminal tendencies and a small-time thief, an untrustworthy person. It's a damning phrase, and it's a phrase that is not without racist implications. And so, and then from what I've been following, this kind of language has really popped up in quite a few places to talk about these guys, and this story is not going to go away quickly. It's not going to go away quickly.
Yeah, at halftime, it seemed that the bond that's been spoken of a little bit in the blogosphere between the Irish and the Mexicans, it could have been furthered by the rather sad prospect of France completely imploding and leading to Mexico's elimination. But I felt that France came out in the second half and actually put on a very professional performance.
Yeah, I still don't understand, because if I remember right, Malouda was subbed in. And Henri usually starts on the bench anyway, so and he also came in later in the game. They looked good in the second half. I mean, I can't even think about their performance, though, in terms of football. I think that everything was so fraught, so overwrought. I mean, there's stories of them being chastised by the head of the sports minister for France, a woman who reduced players to tears. I mean, I've never quite known anything like this, so it's fascinating. So the other thing that actually kind of emerged from my conversations with friends being in Los Angeles, we started to fantasize about a South Korea-Mexico final for the World Cup. Now, I know that the odds against this are very, very long, those are long odds, but we were just sort of dreaming about the mass hysteria that would whip up right in this city. That would be absolutely, we would feel like the absolute center of the world, having more, I believe there's more Koreans living in this region than living anywhere else outside of Korea. That's what I'm going to root for now. That's pretty much got my rooting strategy mapped out for the rest of the course of the World Cup. And so I'm just going to push for those two sides to make it as far as they can so that I can keep this fantasy alive, because that would just make being in L.A., again, all the more fun.
Well, indeed, they are now in the opposite brackets. And, one of the things in the second round of matches today was, of course, I didn't root against Nigeria in the least. In fact, I found myself pulling for them. But the silver lining was, living in Southern California, the passion for the South Korean side is just an amazing thing to be near. And so that's an advantage to having South Korea remain in the tournament and one of the final 16. So, Jennifer, thank you so much for joining me here on our radio show.
Oh, you're welcome. Always a pleasure.
This is The People's Game, and I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined once again by our special Uruguayan analyst, Lazar Trishan. He of the website nomoreonionbags.com. He has to be sky high, even sky higher and sky bluer than before. Uruguay is establishing themselves now as one of the stories of the tournament. Now, let me just say this, because I'm out here in Aslan, and everybody out here is very focused on the Mexican national side. So I paid a lot of attention to how they played, and they seemed flat. So while I didn't hone in on how Uruguay was looking, my sense was they were as sharp and focused as Mexico seemed a little flat. So, Lazar, how did Uruguay look to you today?
Well, we were surprisingly clinical. It's such a surprise, but once again, tactically, we had a game plan, stuck to it, and it worked. Mexico's obviously a great team. Much more athletic than us, perhaps quicker, and a lot of skill in the midfield. But perhaps not as strong on the forward line. So we kind of, rather than against South Africa, where we attacked fully, we drew back a little bit and decided to play the counterattack. And it worked completely. We had an early goal in the first half, but an early miss that could have put us up. And once we got the goal, we gave Mexico the ball and said, try to score on us. And once again, for the third straight game, we did not give up a goal. Kind of incredible.
My sense of Uruguay was this is an organized team, a disciplined team. And there have been teams in the history of the World Cup where there's one real star, a really solid team around them, and those teams have gone very deep, and that is what Uruguay is, because Forlan remains exceptional, and Uruguay is rock solid.
Yeah, another heroic performance for him, and, the team is together, and I think the story of this World Cup is that no matter what your name is, if the team isn't willing to suffer for one another and respect their coach, they're not going to do well. We've seen that with England. We obviously saw that with France. With Italy, there are obviously some questions within the team about the coach. And Uruguay has shown we're willing to stick to the coach's plan and suffer for one another. I think the enduring, Forlan, again, another heroic performance. But the enduring image for me is El Ruso Perez with the bloody head, couldn't wait to come back on, did not care about how many pints of blood were coming out of his head, just wanted to come back on and suffer for the team. And that's really the story. for Uruguay. I will say, though, we have now become, after the end of this game, the biggest Mexico fans, because our arch rival in the team we want to see lose more than anyone is Argentina. So you will have 3 million more Mexico fans, at least, come Sunday.
Last time we spoke, you pointed out to me that if Uruguay were to win the group, and now they've won the group, they have a relatively easy path in front of them. They have to face off against South Korea, and it's only further down the road that they could run into, say, in the semis, Brazil and the Netherlands. So this team can go quite far. Once you get to the semis, you never know what's happened. So how do you feel about it going forward? What do you think about Uruguay, South Korea?
Well, you know, we wanted to miss Argentina, and while we'll be rooting for Mexico, we're glad we don't have to face them. I was rooting for Greece today, hoping they would pull it out so we could face them, because South Korea is quite organized, and the only full game I saw of theirs was their first game against Greece, where they looked fantastic. But, you know, they've been scored on, five or six times in the past two games. You know, with our forwards, if other people can score five or six times on them, we should be able to get one or two against them, and hopefully we can keep another clean sheet. So, you know, I don't want to get too excited, but you're right. South Korea and then potentially Ghana or England, you know, it opens up to the semis.
Obviously, Uruguay has a very privileged place in the history of soccer, and likewise, soccer has a very privileged place in Uruguayan society. What does this mean to the people of Uruguay?
Well, if you go to the Uruguayan newspapers, El País is the biggest one website, you'll see that immediately, despite it being the middle of the day, hundreds and even thousands of people poured out into the streets of Montevideo just celebrating. I mean, for us just to make it to the second round is a huge victory. We haven't been in the second round in 20 years. It's just massive. It's just massive for a small country to get its recognition, and to finish top of the group with big names like France and Mexico is just wonderful. And to do it the way we've done it, you know, you've seen teams like France not really bring pride to their countries, and the way Uruguay has done it, again, that image of El Ruso Perez bleeding but just wanting to be on the team on the field with his teammates is something that I think we're all very proud of.
Lazar Trajan, it looks like this is a media relationship that will be continuing for some time, and we'll talk to you again here on the People's Game.
I hope so.
Lazar Trajan, the website is nomoreonionbags.com. This is the People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined by one of the People's Game team members here, producer Fernando Romero, and we just spoke with Lazar Trajan about the Uruguayan team, which is sky high, feeling happy sky blue about themselves. And Mexico, they advance. That's a good thing. It's a tough group. They have a damn tough opponent next. And as I said in talking to Lazar, I thought they looked pretty flat today. What was your impression of L3?
I think flat would be a really good way to describe it. Just from the get-go, just looking at the starting lineup, it seemed as if though by, you know, placing Cuauhtémoc Blanco as a starting lineup and putting Guillermo Franco, you're kind of setting yourself up for, you know, a very flat game. Franco's he is almost indebted to the national team and to the Mexican fans because he's out of shape, he's out of form, hasn't been scoring lately. He's been just missing really clean, clear shots on goal. The entire game, I'm still trying to question a lot of the substitutions also, taking out Guardado at halftime. And I don't understand. Aguirre he put the team, tactically, the team, some of the players, a setup was almost saying, you know, we don't want to win today. You know, we're just going to go out and, you know, see what happens. Cuauhtémoc, even though for us, you know, a legacy that he's given for the national team, he's not up to par to play a team like Uruguay, who was moving the ball around and it was a very vertical game. Uruguay is known for having possession of the ball, and unfortunately we didn't have it, and Uruguay capitalized on their opportunities, which is something that Mexico didn't. One thing that I did like, and I think a lot of Mexican fans would agree that, Barrera deserves to be a starter. He's been coming on in the second half for the last three games. He's been just changing up the tempo. So I think hopefully for the game against Argentina, he would at least start on the right side.
You know, as we touched on with again, Lazar in the previous interview, Uruguay now has, you know, a relatively easy path ahead of them to advance deep into the tournament. Not so with Mexico. So not only is it a bad performance, but Argentina was strong again today, solid. They didn't really go out trying to, you know, aggressively win the match. They knew a draw would advance them as the winner of their group. but they were very solid, and they ended up getting a sound victory. The firepower, the talent, the professionalism on Argentina, and there's Maradona at this point in no way interfering with that professionalism, and there's motivation. Can you see Mexico getting past Argentina?
You know what? I do. I think if Aguirre makes those changes, you know, putting Guardado as, on the left side, which is more of his position. Today he was playing more towards the center, putting Barrera on the right side. They're going to need a lot of young players to be running up and down against Argentina, because I think that the best way to attack are just probably down the sidelines. You have defenders like, you know, Heinze, and you have, you know, Walter Samuel and Mascherano in the middle. I think the best thing to do will get some young players, guys that can run down the sidelines and try to penetrate the Argentinian goal that way.
And lastly, your thoughts then about how this is resonating in Mexico and in the Southwest, the United States, and
deja vu all over again.
In greater Mexico, as I call it. It's deja vu all over.
It's deja vu. I mean, it's almost exactly as 4 years ago. You know, 4 years ago, Mexico had the same record within the group stage as this World Cup. One win, one draw, one loss. And they played Argentina in the second round in 2006. So, nobody wanted to play Argentina. No one, even when the draw was made for the World Cup in December, people were like really just, you know, anxious to avoid Argentina. But it's you know, here it is. I think Mexico has a really good chance if they just stand up their ground and just go out and just try to win that game.
Well, it is certainly true that if we've spoken often on the People's Game about how, given all of the crises that afflict Greater Mexico, as it were, a successful run in the World Cup would really lift people's spirits.
I think so, too.
And so there's an opportunity in front of Mexico now to really achieve that, because defeating Argentina, with this kind of firepower, would be quantum in the history of Mexican soccer. But that's quite a hurdle.
Yeah. I was looking at the, I don't know what show it was. It was on ESPN Deportes, I think. But they were talking about how every 100 years in Mexico, there's a great event that happens. In 1810, they had the independence from Spain. In 1910, they had the Mexican Revolution.
Here we can say they have a revolution every 100 years.
Yes,
they're not going to say that on the Disney Channel.
But, you know, it's 2010, and maybe this might be the run at the World Cup. Maybe this is the big event at all, you know.
Well, let's combine maybe the damn two. Let's have a run at the World Cup that starts
and
a revolution.
Exactly. I hope so.
What is it? You can't start a fire without a spark?
Exactly.
If they beat Argentina, the people will pour into the streets.
Oh,
so
yes,
the opportunity is in front. And we'll have a lot more to say about it in the coming days on the People's Game.
Sure we will. Thank you.
This is the People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined now by Hamoud Salih. He is a professor of political science at Cal State Dominguez Hills and is a co-host on Radio Intifada on KPFK Radio Los Angeles. Welcome to the People's Game, Hamoud.
Hi, Alan.
Hey, Hamoud. So the big match is Algeria versus USA for this country. Obviously, it's a big match for Algeria and probably for the entire Middle East and perhaps Muslim world. What's being said in the press in Algeria in the lead up to this match?
It's a huge, huge event. It's been depicted as a historical match. It's been perceived and projected as a game between Algeria, the underdog, representing the Arab world and the Muslim world, against a superpower, an imperialist power to some, the United States. The coverage, it's widely covered. Both the radio and television in Algeria have had tremendous coverage. This morning, the Algerian radio had a one-hour a program that is supposedly to be on politics in the region and the Muslim world and the Arab world. It concentrated on the game and what it means. It gave it a political angle, how this is perceived as Algeria's way of rising to the occasion and defeating a great power like the United States. the television also has been playing these games, and Algeria's game particularly, in headlines and all, or they cover the whole World Cup. What's unique about the television is that they began just at the beginning of this World Cup featuring a series on Algerian Americans who have had success here. And what they intended to do is to show that Algeria is not only good in soccer, but it's also, it has this successful Algerians abroad. As you know, Alan, the Algerian national television was at QPFK last year, and now they are showing a series of 10 successful Algerians in the U.S. The press, the printed press, also covered tremendously and with big headlines. The Sunrise, Shuruq al-Arabi, which is the newspaper that is sponsoring the Algerian team, has two-thirds of its coverage on Algeria. What's unique also about this is that they have a few pages on the reaction in the Arab world, and they have interviewed one of the leaders of Hezbollah, quoting him saying that this, if Algeria wins, they will celebrate with fireworks. He also, the Hezbollah representative, also said that they view the match as the same way they viewed when Iran defeated the United States in 1998. The other newspaper, Al-Khabar, which is a major, major newspaper, had the full front page reserved with a big picture of the Algerian team with a headline saying, the glory passes through the United States. And they, too, emphasize the impact of this game. And lastly, another newspaper, Watan, which is very, very well known, it's one of the leading newspapers in the region, did the same thing. And it interviewed the U.S. ambassador in Algiers. And in it, the U.S. ambassador is quoted as saying, no matter what the result, he'll be a winner, meaning that since he's in Algeria, if Algeria wins, he'll be happy. If the Americans wins, he will also be happy. In either case, the game has been depicted as historical, and the newspapers and the television and the radio have raised the occasion from this perspective.
One other question about the anticipation around the match is that there are six nations from Africa, and Algeria is one of the only two nations that has a really legitimate chance to move through to the second round. Ivory Coast is still alive, but they really need to pile up the goals versus North Korea to overcome the deficit they're in terms of the goal spread versus Portugal. So they're virtually eliminated, and only Ghana and Algeria are remaining. Has much been written about that fact, that Algeria could end up being the only team from Africa to go through into the second round?
Yeah, they have made a note of this, and this is why the stakes are very high in Algeria. Now, it's not only the representative of the Arab world, the Muslim world, but also the African nation. And they use it as a means to project this team as one of the representatives of the entire, even the third world. So they are playing on it, and they understand that, and it's highly written about. And so they have not ignored that, and they have focused on that too.
Well, also, Hamoud, you're a big soccer fan. What is your analysis of the strength and weaknesses of the Algerian side?
I think the Algerian side strength is the spirit. They are very, very nationalistic, and they play with the heart. And they've seen this on a lot of occasions. We've seen them when they lost in Egypt and then come back and won in Egypt in Cairo and then come back and won the game in Sudan, Khartoum. They seem to to do well when they are cornered, in a sense, when they think that this is a game of their lives. So from that perspective, this game is an incentive for them, and it's highly likely that the emotional side, the drive to win, will be a big factor here. Their weakness is the offense. So far, they have not been scoring any goals, and the Algerian press is saying this is partly tactical. They're blaming the coach. But their scoring has been low. This is not the first time. It has been a pattern, and they seem to win by the defense more so than the offense.
The United States team, I think, remains and has always been something of a wild card team, a difficult team to get a grip on. It's not a team that traditionally has a very clear sense of national soccer style or identity. And I think that's still true of this side, certainly a team that has a good amount of firepower. And actually, in contrast to the previous stronger sides in U.S. soccer history, it's actually the defense which is weaker on this particular team. How do you think Algeria matches up against this USA team?
I think they match very well. A lot of players in the U.S. team are also know the Algerian players too. They play together in many European countries, particularly in France. The players know each other very, very well. But you're correct; the defense has been a problem, and I don't think the biggest strength and what the Algerians fear is the physical nature of the American team. They seem, from the Algerian perspective, to play to the strength, using a lot of physical bodies and things like that. So, from that perspective, the Algerians seems to be concerned about that. But the players do know each other, and as you're correct, it seems to be the defense has been a problem for the U.S. But they also seem to always get caught, do better in the second half when they play behind. And in both games, as we've seen, that was a factor, and they, a tie perhaps saved them in a lot of ways.
And again, the configuration in the group is quite complex, in part because everyone still sort of expects England to win, and who really knows what England will put out as a performance tomorrow, because they have been so below expectations. It's watching Wayne Rooney, as much as I have in the British Premiership, it's really hard to believe that he won't be closer to how he is every week for Manchester United than how terrible he has been for England. But Slovakia is ahead with 4 points. America and England both have 2 and Algeria 1. So that clearly means Algeria has to win. They do have to push the game. They have to score some goals. And in that sense, it should be an open match because they've been relying on a defensive strategy. But it's quite complex in that if England does beat Slovakia and Algeria wins, then they tie Slovakia on goals. It's very complex, and there's the rules of FIFA, and people are probably going to be alerted on whatever broadcast they're watching. But what is clear is Algeria needs a victory, and in all likelihood, so does the USA, so it should be a very open match.
Yeah, it should be. Speaking of FIFA, FIFA thinks that the Algerians have a better chance. A win for Algeria and a loss for England will get them in.
Right.
Beyond that, it's really very, very complex. And the Algerian newspaper, speaking again about the press, details this, all the scenarios, and that they remain with high hopes that they will get the win, and they will go to the second round.
Right, and just in sort of in summary, to make it a little bit simpler for listeners, in most American sports, when there's a tie, that first tiebreaker is head-to-head competition. That's not the case in FIFA. It actually remains group goal differential, and only if they're exactly the same does it come down to Slovakia having the fact that they beat Algeria being the deciding factor. So, again, it's complex, and it'll be explained throughout the course of the match, depending on how things are breaking.
Last point also, in case the United States and England got the same point and the goal differential is the same, it will be a toss-up. Basically, they will throw the coin, and whoever gets it will win.
Right. That will not happen. Right. Yeah. Correct. That can't happen if Algeria ties Slovakia, because somewhere down the line, the fact that Slovakia beat Algeria will tip them. But it's true that if USA and England, it could come down to a coin flip. It's the first group where that's within the range of possibilities. Well, Hamoud Salih, where are you watching the match tomorrow?
I think I'll be at home. It's too early for me to go out, but we'll see.
Well, enjoy the match, and we'll speak to you again here on The People's Game.
Thanks, Alan.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined on the line by Kevin, who works at a restaurant in Los Angeles called Wurst Kruka. And Kevin is an American who grew up in Germany and is a passionate supporter of the German national team. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Thank you.
First off, where will you watch the game tomorrow versus Ghana? Will you watch it with other German fans? Because, you know, there are collections of Germans who watch it in Los Angeles. This is such an international metropolitan area. I know the Goethe Institute has screenings. But where will you watch tomorrow's very important match?
Well, I am actually going to go against the grain and stick with my American friends. It is going to be early in the morning, and being a bartender, that's right about the time I wake up at 11:30. So that being said, I'm going to crash at my buddy's house in North Hollywood. There's a big slumber party. We're all going to get up and watch the game tomorrow morning.
Okay, so what do you make of the German national team this year? Because they started it out with a bang against Australia. All of a sudden, they were the tournament favorites. A somewhat unfair red card. Very quick set of cards to Klose. All of a sudden, they're down a man. All of a sudden, they're in trouble. What do you make of their chances tomorrow against Ghana?
I think they have great chances. I mean, I guess technically speaking, they aren't in trouble. That being said, last game was kind of a fluke. I think that they did demonstrate what they're capable of against Australia. And I actually saw them play 4 years ago and was a little worried coming into this tournament, Bolic being gone and the players being young. But that being said, watching them play against Australia, I was really surprised. I thought they looked better than they did 4 years ago. And 4 years ago, I thought they were by far the best team in the tournament. So I think Ghana will go as planned. I don't think they're going to have a problem. That being said, every game counts, and they're going to have to give it their all, but I think chances are definitely in their favor.
Were you in Los Angeles for the 2006 World Cup?
No, I was in Germany, actually.
How was that?
It was one of the most incredible experiences of my life. The energy, having countries come into that place from all around the world, it was obviously an international experience, but it was really special. And also, Germany, I think, for the first time, felt a little bit of national pride, which ever since World War II, that's something that has definitely been dumbed down. And for the first time in decades, you saw German flags all around the city, and people were passionate and just proud to be able to host the event. So it was really cool thing to be a part of.
One of the subtexts of tomorrow's game is that Michael Ballack, the German captain, was actually injured by a player who plays for Ghana, whose relative plays for Germany. Do you think that'll add an even extra layer of emotion to tomorrow's match?
Yeah, I'm sure it will. These guys are used to playing with and against each other in their regular club teams. So, I mean, that's not so unusual. The irony of Bolic's situation is funny. I'm sure that'll play into it. But in all honesty, I think it'll give them a little bit more emotional fuel and drive to seal the deal against Ghana.
Yeah, and it will be a very, very emotional environment, especially if Algeria is eliminated earlier in the day, because then in all likelihood, since Ivory Coast would have to just slaughter North Korea to catch up to Portugal on goal difference and then still hope that Portugal gets no points against Brazil, in all likelihood, if Algeria is out by then, Ghana will be the last hope for Africa. So it'll be a very emotional environment. And Kevin, thank you for joining us on the People's Game, and enjoy the game tomorrow.
Great, thanks. Thanks for having me.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined right now by a man who made a cameo appearance on The People's Game the other day when we were talking with Toby Miller, Ian Masters. Ian Masters is the host of both Daily Briefing and Background Briefing on KPFK Radio Los Angeles. He is also an Australian national, and as no doubt all of you who are great soccer historians know, and if you know this boy, you get three extra gold stars, his great-uncle, is that right? Great-uncle.
My father's uncle.
Your father's uncle was the captain of the Australian national team in the 1920s, James Judy Masters. So, Ian, you must know intimately the Australian national soccer team. It's part of your lineage. What do you make of this year's side?
Well, everybody says that the team that was in the 06 World Cup, the last one, clearly was good and shook the Italians. And you recall the bad call in the goal. They held them to a scoreless tie in the last minute. The bad call against them gave the Italians the victory. So they felt robbed back then, and they sure feel robbed this now. Of course, they're older than they were last time, so I think that's a disadvantage. They seem to be totally shell-shocked by their 4-0 defeat by Germany, but they did come back. They're hanging by a thread. you know, all this complicated stuff about whether Ghana loses and they win and whatever. Who knows what their fate is. But I don't think they're as good as they were last time, but they certainly came back a little in the last game.
How much sense of injustice has filled the hearts of Australian football fans this past week?
Well, no more than it's filled the hearts of American fans. I mean, it's clearly a systemic problem here that more of these games have been decided by officials and not by the skill of the players. And it's deeply dysfunctional, and FIFA is a secretive organization that has to accept some transparency, and there has to be some kind of reforms, because this is just ridiculous, and it goes on and on. But certainly the penalty against the player in the goal the other day, where he was hit by a really fast ball, and he had no way to get out of the way, and that was called a handball. That was a bad call. It gave Ghana an easy goal, the penalty, and that was a draw. So I think they redeemed themselves a little. Serbia is a pretty tough team, so if they beat Serbia, then it's a question of what happens with Ghana and Germany, and it all gets very complicated.
Yeah, Serbia is definitely a team. If they do get by them, they probably won't do it with a lot of goals, so they'd be relying upon Germany piling on goals to beat Ghana. But, you know, that's within Germany's capacity, so it's not all over. We'll see what happens. But Serbia is a very formidable opponent, so we'll see how that game goes.
Apparently, by the way, you know how the British press have been piling on the poor, unfortunate goalkeeper. The Australian press were piling on, they call them the Socceroos.
Right.
And they were really, after the German defeat, the Crockeroos, all kinds of things. They were really on their case. And funnily enough, to some extent, the New Zealand team is giving the kind of antipodes and a little extra boost there. So I guess if Australia gets eliminated, people will still feel good about New Zealand, because they've come out of nowhere.
Now, let me ask you this, because soccer hasn't really been the primary sport of Australia. One thinks of, well, they think of course, Australian rules football, rugby, and cricket, and soccer sort of being down amongst those.
It's a bit like it is here. The relationship to soccer, to NFL football here, is about the same to rugby, and there's different types of rugby in Australia. Australian rules, rugby union, and rugby league. But league is the big game, like the NFL. So they're way down but Australia is a nation of immigrants like the United States. A lot of immigrants from Italy and Greece, after World War II did, bolster the ranks of soccer. I don't recall that they did an AYSO type thing that they've done here. I coached my daughter for about 10 years, and she also did pretty well.
One of the sub-themes in this show, of course, is soccer and globalization. And as globalization makes the world smaller, and Mr. Murdoch's holdings, of course, include the rights to the British Premiership, Murdoch, of course, being Australian, soccer is penetrating this market. Is the sort of penetration of the Australian market much greater now for soccer, or are you aware of that?
I think soccer basically is not telegenic. That's its problem. It's continuous. There's no stop for commercials.
I mean, there's no stop for commercials. That doesn't make it non-telegenic.
Oh, well, in the civilized world, they don't worry about that. But here in the commercial US and in the very commercial Australia, and certainly in the very commercial Rupert Murdoch world, I mean, he's tried to take over cricket. He's tried to take over rugby. He's not exactly popular, you know, in Australia.
Well, it does seem like, though, as soccer penetrates the United States now, this is a key month in the history of that taking place, and it might be an unstoppable wave. It might just be too many people have too much passion for it already within the United States, and, of course, time will tell. And I do think whether this is the month where there's a breakthrough, at least in the United States, a lot hinges on how Team USA does, for instance, in their next match. Do they go into the second round? Probably doesn't seem to be the case in Australia, but my sense, looking at Australian football culture as it stands now, is the year that the Socceroos get through, say, a second round, the thing will explode in Australia. They'll become as big as the national cricket stars, who are huge stars in Australia.
Yeah, it's possible, but I do think there are real similarities, basically, between the U.S. and Australia in terms of where soccer fits in the overall sports. But Australians are so nuts about all kinds of sports. There's no way that it's going to go away.
And so lastly, then, it is true, then, these games are followed
just when the national team does make the World Cup, they're followed religiously in Australia.
Oh, yeah, yeah, no. One of the good things about Australia is that it's not nationalistic and jingoistic. But when it comes to sports, it is. I mean, by and large, you know, they don't salute the flag and put their hand over their heart and do all that stuff, which I think is kind of healthy. But when it comes to sport, they can be, along with being a bunch of rowdy drunks, they can also be very jingoistic.
Well, Ian Masters, thank you for joining us on The People's Game.
Oh, pleasure.